or not in terms of operator implementation, but
The tensor product of n qubit things does,
yeah.
But this is only 2-qubit.
Yeah, since I'm only allowing.
I see. Oh,
it's
I see.
The yeah. I and the I plus one that you probably didn't see. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So does anyone else have a question about this picture here of these two intersecting subspaces and why that intersection would be this set of possible reconstructed Hamiltonians? Cool. So on one hand, yeah, this is just calculating the intersection of two linear subspaces, and it should be a very doable problem. It's sort of a linear problem in that sense. On the other hand, these are linear subspaces of an exponentially large ambient space, which is the space of all operators. And also, this sort of required us to know the full quantum, the full eigenstate, all of its components, so that we could then form the linear subspace of things with that as an eigenstate. So doing this numerically would require working this exponentially large space if you were to do it naively. So that would make us pessimistic. On the other hand, it should seem like sort of overkill, because there's this well-known fact that an eigenstate of a local Hamiltonian, all of its components are fully determined by just looking at its two-body reduced density matrices. So if you can reconstruct the eigenstate from just its two-body reduced density matrices, then, which that's actually, that's a hard problem. But just knowing that you can do that in principle, that should suggest that maybe we can reconstruct the Hamiltonian from just the two-body reduced density matrices. Maybe we don't need to go through this exponentially large state object.
When you say two-body, you mean like reduced density matrices for two sites?
Yeah, great. When I said two-body, I meant reduced density matrices on bipartite regions that might be of length k.
Oh,
each.
Okay.
So that's the.
But the assumption here is that this Hamiltonian has a unique ground state.
Yeah. I'm going to be making a bunch of simplifications here, and I can talk about generalizing later. But I'm talking about when you have a unique ground state.
So that fact. Are you going to talk more about it, or if not, where do you find that showing?
You know, I'll say it. It's like one sentence. It's that maybe ask me at the end. It'll be, it's like one sentence, but it's an even shorter sentence after I say a few more things. Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to try to talk about this method. It's really simple. It's like it's going to be a few lines of math that I'm going to show you. And it will lead us to a way of getting an efficient reconstruction of the Hamiltonian given only these two-point correlations of all the local observables. By two-point correlations of local observables, I mean you have an observable here, we look at the connected correlation, and each observable is local to a region of size k, so like 2 in the spin chain case, in the nearest neighbor spin chain case. And just using all of those connected correlations, we're going to try to figure out what the Hamiltonian was. This is a lot less data to start with than knowing the full state. Like the connected correlations of small, of local observables are the sort of thing that you might actually measure in the lab. Okay, yeah. Now I'm going to go through some math, and I'm going to like write a lot of math on the slides, but it's pretty simple math, so I think we can do it. So this is the space of all local Hamiltonians that's a subspace of the space of all operators. And in the spin chain example, this will apply to other lattices and next nearest neighbors in a very simple way, but I'm going to stick with the spin chain example and nearest neighbor couplings to make everything very concrete here. So it's the span of all of these poly operators for all combinations of polys on site I and I plus 1. And that linear span of operators, that's like the space of local Hamiltonians, that's our space here. And then we want to look for the operators in this space that have B as an eigenstate. That's our intersection I drew before. Okay, first this simple fact that O having V as an eigenstate is the same thing as O having zero fluctuation in V, zero variance in V. Those brackets are just V expectation values. So with that in mind, We're going to define this correlation matrix whose ijth component is the connected correlation of the li and lj operators, where these li operators are any orthonormal basis in the Hilbert-Schmidt norm of the space of local Hamiltonians. So, for example, for our basis li, we could have chosen the operators that I wrote right here, the sigma I A, sigma B I plus one. If we that list of operators could be our LI list of operators. But any orthonormal basis, we define this correlation matrix. It's symmetrized, but otherwise it's like an ordinary connected correlation. Yeah, like I just said. So we have our correlation matrix. We have our condition that an operator has V as an eigenstate. So just note that if we had any operator in this space, any local operator, we could express it in terms of its Li components, in that then its fluctuation with respect to V, you can get by acting with M, like a bilinear form, on our components here. So you can think of M as this bilinear form that takes operators and tells you their connected correlations. So vectors in the kernel of our correlation matrix, they have components, they're components in this basis of Li operators. They have component C such that when you build up this operator, that operator has V as an eigenstate. Why? Well, let's take this operator. Let's compute its variance in the state V. Because C is in the kernel, we get zero. So that means that it has zero variance in the state V, which means that it has V as an eigenstate. It is very simple, but maybe you need to look at it for a second. Does anyone have any questions about that?
Yeah, so I see that if you contract C from both sides, then you get zero. But I don't see why just from one side you should get zero. So why?
Great question. So it's a positive semi-definite operator, just like looking at its definition here. And that means that something that when you contract it on both sides gives zero, that's equivalent to just contracting on one side and giving zero because it's a positive operator.
Could you go back one slide?
Yeah, please slow me down here because this is like most of the math that will occur, and I promise it's very understandable. So ask a question if you miss something. Cool. So, what's our procedure for finding the Hamiltonian? We construct the correlation matrix by calculating all these connected correlations of all the local observables. Then we find the kernel, and then each vector in that kernel is the coefficients of a candidate Hamiltonian in this basis Li. And all these candidate Hamiltonians are these local Hamiltonians that have the state as an eigenstate. So that was what we were trying to reconstruct. Now, if the kernel is one-dimensional, that means that there's a unique Hamiltonian that has that state as an eigenstate. That means that you reconstructed the unique Hamiltonian with that eigenstate.
Sorry, so the other Hamiltonians will have it as an eigenstate, but it might not be the ground state, for instance.
That's true. You're right. If you looked at, yeah, so let's say I gave you the eigenstate, you constructed the correlation matrix, you found the kernel, and now you get a two-dimensional space, but you find that only one element in that space actually has it as a ground state, the others have it as excited states, that would tell you, then you could still find the grounds. You could still find which Hamiltonian it was. But I'm gonna be arguing that usually you get a unique space, a one-dimensional kernel anyway, so.
Just going back, this property that expectation value O squared is equal to expectation of O squared, That's if and only if it's an eigenstate, then.
Yeah. Are you saying or asking? But yes.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm concluding that it must be the case from what you claimed. But so it's kind of somewhere between stating and asking.
Great, yeah.
Right, yes.
Here's our if and only if. I mean, yeah, how do you see this? Imagine expressing V in terms of an eigenstate, in terms of the basis of eigenstates of O, and it pops out immediately. Okay, so does it actually work? We can talk about general cases in a second, but let's just like take a little spin chain with a nearest neighbor Hamiltonian. Let's say we randomly generate the coefficients, so it's like a random local Hamiltonian on our spin chain. We pick a random eigenstate from anywhere in the spectrum. We take that eigenstate. We throw away, we pretend we didn't know what the Hamiltonian was. We calculate this correlation matrix. We diagonalize it. And then we look at the kernel. And do we get the Hamiltonian? And yes, you do. On this little example, you get it exactly, up to numerical error. OK, so the real question is, does this work in general? It worked for the Dinky example. One little comment is that if you're wondering whether it works for 12-qubit nearest neighbor Hamiltonians in general, then you can prove that if it works for one example, so like the example that I just told you about that you would need to believe me, if it works for that one example where I randomly generate the coefficients, then it should work for all but a measure zero set of local Hamiltonians on 12 qubits. That little result just uses the analyticity of the eigenvalues as you vary the coefficients of the Hamiltonian. But it doesn't tell you about what happens in the thermodynamic limit, basically because you can have interesting phase structure to Hamiltonians there where the eigenvalues are no longer analytic function of the coefficients of your Hamiltonian. So this is really, this comment is only about small systems. So I did just claim to you that if you do this for 12 qubits with probability 1, you'll get a unique Hamiltonian from say, the ground state. Of course, that's probability 1. It's not all examples. So what are some examples where it doesn't work? Well, let's say your Hamiltonian was non-interacting. Let's say it was just a sum of single site terms, sigma z terms. Then the ground state is just a product state. And there's going to be lots of other local Hamiltonians that also have that ground state. But as soon as you perturb a little bit away from that, you get some entanglement in your ground state, then this will work in this 12-qubit case.
Wait, that's just a 12-qubit case. I mean, even then, if you just have enough entanglement that just goes over like two lattice sites, won't there be many like two Hamiltonians or three Hamiltonians?
Yeah, but I think I understand what you're asking, but as soon as you turn on a little bit of interactions, then the ground state will have, you'll generate a little bit of mutual information between any two sites, even if you just generate a small amount. It'll be entangled over more than just one site.
When you're measuring the state in the lab, do you have to then measure it with exponential precision?
Yeah, you're right to then ask about exactly the robustness of the reconstruction procedure. And if the state, if the Hamiltonian has almost no interactions, it's almost single site, then the ground state will be almost a product state. And then you'll get a not robust reconstruction procedure. And we'll see how to quantify that in a second. OK, really, we should be interested in systems in the thermodynamic limit. Before tackling that question, it's useful to tackle a few other things, like the robustness to error that Jess just mentioned. Also, if we think about a system in the lab, some huge system, we don't want to measure correlations between every pair of observables on all different sites in our lattice just to reconstruct the Hamiltonian. We'd like to just measure correlations in a single region, do some, you know, finite number of measurements, and then reconstruct the Hamiltonian. And this question of can you reconstruct from a subregion is sort of related to the thermodynamic limit question. I'm not going to give rigorous answers to these, but I'm going to give some intuition and, yeah. So to talk about robustness and to talk about the subregion question, it's useful to actually look at the whole spectrum of our correlation matrix. Before, we were just thinking about the kernel, because the kernel contained these candidate Hamiltonians, but you can look at the other eigenvalues too, right? So you can define this correlation spectrum for any state. You don't even need to, independent of my whole talk, you could just define this correlation spectrum and it would give you some interesting data about a state. It's this data that's interesting for one because it tells you about correlations and entanglement, and it also doesn't, it's also independent under local unitaries. So it's sort of a nice quantity in that sense. Another.
Wait, yeah. You said it's invariant under local unitaries. I can imagine it's invariant under like local circuits, but a local unitary will spread an operator.
Oh, sorry, but by local unitaries, I meant single site. Maybe that answers your question. Yeah. What another geometrical interpretation of these eigenvalues of the correlation matrix is that they're like the principal angles between the two subspaces I drew up before. Principal angles, you know, if you have two if you have two planes in high dimension, they don't just have an angle between them. They have lots of angles between them. So that's sort of what principal angles are. So for one, you can show that if you look at the gap between the smallest eigenvalue of the correlation matrix and the next smallest, that tells you about the sensitivity of the reconstruction. From a sort of numerical perspective, that makes sense because if we're trying to find the kernel of this matrix, but it has another very low-lying eigenvalue, then that becomes a hard numerical problem if you're used to thinking about these things numerically. It's hard to find that kernel when there's another nearby eigenvalue. So this here, this equation that I put up, is telling you that the angle between the actual Hamiltonian and the reconstructed Hamiltonian, that's like a measure of their error, that's their like angle is projective vectors, that angle is bounded by something like one is proportional to 1 over the gap between that 0 eigenvector of the correlation matrix and the next highest eigenvector. So now let me just throw up a correlation spectrum for some state. So this is the ground state of some 10 qubit spin chain Hamiltonian. And what I'm plotting is I'm just plotting all of these eigenvalues in the correlation spectrum. I'm just sorting them and plotting the 0th eigenvalue, the next eigenvalue, et cetera. You can see that there's only one eigenvalue at, there's only one 0 eigenvalue. So this has a unique kernel. So this is one of our generic examples where we're able to reconstruct the Hamiltonian exactly. And then there's this little gap that I mentioned before that's controlling the sensitivity of the reconstruction. And that gap might look small, which might concern you, because I said that 1 over the gap was controlling the sensitivity of the reconstruction. But I'll talk about that in a minute. I'll pause for questions again. Does anyone have questions here? Do you understand what figure you're looking at?
We're not supposed to understand the gap yet.
I didn't tell you about this gap or this gap. I didn't tell you why it looks like what it looks like, but at least what it's plotting. Yeah, so there's this weird gap in the spectrum that I haven't explained yet either. So we'll get to that in a second. So it actually helps to understand this correlation spectrum. It helps a lot to look at translation invariant Hamiltonians. That'll help us understand the general case. And why does it help to look at translation invariant Hamiltonians? Well, there, instead of just plotting the spectrum, we can plot the spectrum and then also plot the spectrum according to momentum eigenvalues. So what I mean is that this correlation matrix, it's this bilinear form on the space of local operators. It it commutes with a translation of your lattice, if you have a translation invariant state, which means that we can label all of our eigenvalues according to their momentum eigenvalue as well. It means that the eigenoperators of this correlation matrix will be of this form for some q. Does that make sense? So now instead of just plotting the eigenvalues, we can plot them according to both their eigenvalue and then their momentum, the momentum of that eigenvalue. So here, I just threw up, this is a pretty generic looking, this is a typical picture. This is what you get for the correlation spectrum of the ground state of some big spin chain Hamiltonian. So again, there's this unique zero at, there's this unique zero eigenvalue. That means that our reconstruction will be unique. So why does it look like this? So let's first talk about this left column. This is all the translation invariant operators. This is operators with q equals zero. And I told you that the q equals zero operators will be translation invariant because that's the q here. Now the bottom row, and then the h is the lowest eigenvalue of all those translation invariant operators. The bottom row, these are operators that turn out to look like energy density Fourier components, by which I literally mean just this here. So if these are the terms in your Hamiltonian, then for q equals zero, this is just the Hamiltonian. But for a different q, this is like your Hamiltonian multiplied by some Fourier wave. And why do these operators appear at the bottom of the correlation spectrum? Well, these operators have very low variance. They have very low fluctuation in the state. The Hamiltonian itself has zero fluctuation in the state, but one of these slowly changing energy density components also has low fluctuation in the state. So meanwhile, there's this gap that I still didn't explain.
Sorry, can I maybe ask a question here? So you got this by starting with a translation invariant Hamiltonian, and you found the ground state, and then the correlation spectrum from that.
Yeah.
But is it a unique ground state? I mean, if you have a translation invariant Hamiltonian, generally it won't be a unique ground state. A lot of ground states that are themselves not translation invariant, but they have to be shifted by translations.
Maybe you have a different intuition, but I think that the ground state of a generic translation invariant Hamiltonian on the spin chain like this is unique.
You have a different intuition.
Yeah, okay, and say again why you're thinking it's not unique.
Maybe not for qubits, I guess, is possible. But in more complicated systems, I would expect that it would be frustrated, and in such a way that, you know, well.
So these are definitely frustrated.
Yeah. Okay. I'm not sure if I can explain the intuition very well, but basically. I would expect that kind of as you start to solve the constraints, you're going to get something that's non-translation invariant. But of course, because the whole thing is translation invariant, if you shift it by a certain amount, that will be another solution as well.
I think that's the intuition behind Liebscholz-Mattis theorem, that you have the alternative between like preserving some symmetry and preserving translation symmetry, and sometimes you get an alternative that either the system has a gapless excitation or it spontaneously breaks some symmetry, like translation symmetry.
Yeah.
Most of the ones that I know, most of the like local Hamiltonians that I know of, the ground ground state is unique in translation.
Are you suggesting that there will be states that are not quite translation invariant and not quite eigen? Okay.
No, I'm saying as, and again, for one dimension in qubits, I guess I can believe that this would not happen. But if you go to two dimensions, or if you go to qubits, or really significantly any kind of significantly more complicated system, I would expect that the generic Hamiltonian will have some ground states that are not at all translational invariant. Of course, they will always have a translational invariant ground state because, like I said,
yeah, you mean because they'll be degenerate, though. You mean
you can take
yeah.
some of that, but that means it'll be degenerate. Yeah.
Does that apply to all energy eigenspaces?
I didn't really think about the excited states ever. But.
Yeah. I'm curious to... Afterwards, I'll ask you a little more, because I'm curious where the intuition comes from, and you might well be right. I have the best...
The real question is whether it's a generic property or a special property.
Yeah. I'm curious, too. I'm fairly certain for one dimension, and then higher dimensional lattice models, I'm not so sure, although my intuition from field theory would tell me that there's even generically a gapped unique ground state.
But field theory, I think, is not a good guide, because that's you're assuming like lots of symmetries essentially, so a lot more than just translation invariance.
Mm-hmm. A little more.
And very special interactions and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah, I'm curious to ask you more. So the only thing I'll actually say about this gap for now, the gap in red, is that if you look at the correlation spectrum for a product state, you'll see that it is a bunch of bands that are exactly at zero, and then a bunch of bands up where those top bands are that are exactly together as well. And you can sort of understand why a product state has that structure if you think about it. And then if you apply a local unitary circuit to produce your ground state in some trivial phase ground state, then that applying that local unitary circuit for small depth will spread out the bands but preserve this gap. That's just my understanding at the moment.
Sorry, yeah. Question. So not just for the ground state, but the other states, is there a degeneracy? We have these symmetric functions, and then the dots are kind of, you know, some smattering on them. And is the idea that they're kind of slightly aligned so that when you push them all onto the vertical axis, they will all be distinct?
I think that they are...
degeneracy for all of these if you just looked at the energy spectrum?
In the thermo... You mean if you collapse and just look at all of the spectrum at once?
Finite,
yeah.
40 qubits.
Oh, I mean, for finite, then they're all generically non-degenerate. But in the thermodynamic limit, right, where you're getting smoother and smoother bands,
yes,
then they will be degenerate in that. Okay, so I know I just threw a lot of sort of not fully resolved information at you, but just to recap, can we uniquely recover the Hamiltonian? Well, on small spin chains, I already told you yes. I'll go more into this if you ask about it, but
the system size, I don't know if this is a well-formed question. Does that like polynomial or exponential? Does it just become impossible for 40 spins?
With 40 spins. For like 20, it's possible. I don't know about 40. But this is for non-translation invariant.
Yeah.
And then for translation invariant eigenstates, the situation is very different in the thermodynamic limit. So for translation invariant eigenstates, it's very different. So when you know that your Hamiltonian is translation invariant, that means that even though you can produce this whole spectrum, you're only going to look at the eigenvalues in this left column, because those are the only translation invariant candidate Hamiltonians. So you don't care about these eigenvalues that are close to zero. You only care about the gap in this vertical column. And I could say more about that, but that, I think, will be stable in the thermodynamic limit. The values in this left column here, as you increase the number of sites, the bands will fill out and become smooth, but where they end on this axis will remain stable. So as I go to the thermodynamic limit, you're just gonna fill out these bands and make them very smooth, but you're gonna keep those gaps between where the bands intersect the left column. Yeah, so there's a lot more material I could go into, but I'll leave that to any questions if anyone's interested. I think there's a lot more to ask about learning about the correlation structure of the state by looking at these interesting bands. And as for a practical method, I think it's clear that at least for one-dimensional spin chains, you could definitely use this to reconstruct the Hamiltonian from measuring correlations. And I didn't talk about it yet, but even if you just looked at correlations in a subregion for a translation variant Hamiltonian, you would be able to reconstruct the Hamiltonian. Okay, yeah, thanks. That's it for now.
Can you say more about reconstructing states from knowing correlations between K local operators and parts of the system?
Yeah, so in the case that it's a translation invariant Hamiltonian, then it's pretty clear what to say there. If I only have access to some little region of my whole spin chain, and I measure all of the correlation functions of local observables, but with regions that are within that little region, then, so it's what I mean, there's like, maybe we can measure on a foot of our spin chain, but the spin chain is many feet long. This is sort of silly. But then you measure two site, those units should be smaller. Then you measure the two-body correlations within that foot region of the spin chain. I now feel silly for saying a foot. but then could you figure out what the correlations, could you figure out what the Hamiltonian is? Well, because of the exponential decay of correlations for a gapped ground state, then you basically know all of the correlations by just knowing them on some small region. So then you could fill out the rest of your correlation matrix approximately only looking at the correlations within that region. And yeah, something like that. And that is something that you can easily write out, and it does work numerically for a translation variant spin chain. You look at just, you know, 10 sites out of 40 sites, but you can still figure out what the Hamiltonian is.
But that's specific to states which have exponentially decaying correlations.
Yes. Yes. I didn't talk about the. Here's a very different case. If you take, instead of the ground state, a highly excited state, and then you think about a system, a very large volume system, then the reduced density matrix is going to look thermal. This is the sort of situation that Harrison and Grover were talking about. So now the question is, from that thermal reduced density matrix on our region, can we figure out what the Hamiltonian was? In one sense, yes, you can, because it looks like e to the negative beta h. So if you had done tomography on your whole region and you knew that whole state in the region, then you could just take the state and take the log and you would have the Hamiltonian. On the other hand, to figure out if we... Yeah, on the other hand, to learn the state on a region when it's a highly thermal state, you won't necessarily be able to learn that from looking at local correlations anymore.
Right. Okay. Maybe you have answered my question, but I just remember you stating this fact that it's something like psi determined by two-point correlation functions of k with qubit operators.
Maybe I was jumping ahead and thought you were asking about the subtlety of when you only look at the two-body correlations in a
Yeah, I think, yeah, it was one of these blue slides.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Put the statement up here.
There.
Yeah. Sorry, you were just asking about this as I promised I would answer you later. Sorry, I misunderstood. Okay. So, how can we see this? Well,
I mean, the energy is clearly given by the two-body reduced density matrix.
Yeah, exactly. So that's where this sentence is going. So that eigenstate, this requires that it's a non-degenerate eigenstate, I should have said.
Oh, okay. So here you're given the eigenstate, and you're given the local Hamiltonian, so you're given all the eigenstates because you can diagonalize it, and the only task here is to determine which eigenstate you've been given. I'm just trying to understand
that. Sorry, let me, that's not quite right, but let me think a second and say it. So, yeah, I'm actually gonna say, I'm gonna say it in two steps.
Okay.
Is this, people see the board?
Yes.
So, so this is true. So this is saying that if we,
yeah.
So this says that if we only know the one-body reduced density matrices of some state, psi,
yeah,
then we can figure out what the full state is,
yeah,
because it's the unique state that has lowest energy.
Yeah, I slightly misunderstood the statement of that. I think maybe that technically is ambiguous in the sense that suppose you give me a state and you tell me that it's the eigenstate of some local Hamiltonian, but you don't give me the Hamiltonian. I thought that you were reconstructing all bits of information in that wave function just from the two-body reduced density matrices.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that is, okay.
I mean, that's what you do later on, is reconstruct the Hamiltonian from the two-body. But this is not saying that you know how to do that, right? This is earlier on the top.
Okay. Okay, yes, you're right that a way for me to answer your question would just be to say, look, I actually showed you how to do it later.
Yeah, okay.
However, there is this fact that, I'm getting a little, what you said is also true, and I'm getting a little confused now with the board, so I'll just need to answer you in a second. Let me think for 10 seconds, see if I can. Yeah, so let me, just because this is a good little fact, let me try to convince you of this, and then I'm doing the ground state case, not the eigenstate case, because it'll be a little clearer. But we're gonna, let's say there's some state psi that is the unique ground state of some local Hamiltonian.
Sure.
And let's say you don't know what the Hamiltonian is, you don't even know what psi is, you just know what its one body reduced density matrices are. By one body, I actually mean k sites together for k local Hamiltonian. Okay, so now you just have all these reduced density matrices. You want to figure out what the state was. It, forget my whole procedure. This is a separate fact, right?
Yeah.
So, you look for the state. Let's say there were another state that had, I'm going to prove to you abstractly that that's the unique state with those marginals, with those reduced density matrices. Let's say there were another state with those same one-body marginals.
Sure.
Then that state would have the same energy, because you can calculate the energy only looking at the one-body marginals. But we said it was a unique ground state of a Hamiltonian, so there's not another state with the same energy. So I didn't give you an algorithm for finding what the state was from its marginals, but I proved to you abstractly that there is a unique, that the inverse marginal problem for such a state is uniquely determined.
Okay. In fact, it's, you can also prove that it's computationally hard to find the state,
mm-hmm.
given those marginals.
Yeah, exactly, which is why it's cool that in my talk here, we start with the marginals and we don't figure out the state, because that is computationally hard. We do figure out the Hamiltonian. And then why did that not shortcut your hardness thing? Because now to find the state from the Hamiltonian, to find the full, we constructed the reconstructed the Hamiltonian, but to actually get to the full ground state, that's the hard problem of finding a ground state of a Hamiltonian. So we didn't shortcut any hard things, but we jumped straight from the marginals to the Hamiltonian. Okay, yeah, thanks.